This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with author Naomi Wolf, the well-known feminist and political advisor from San Francisco. She is back with her most controversial work of her career, and we'll talk with her about this, as well as the 2012 campaign and her association with Albert Gore in 2000. Also on the show, Stephen Ortego, state representative. He's upset about cuts to health care in Louisiana to the charity hospital system. We will talk with him about Governor Jindal's maneuvers and what has happened regarding health care in our state. And Ray Gleer, his book is How the SEC Became Goliath, the Making of College Football's Most Dominant Conference. All these guests today, but first the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 877-217-5757, wherever you are. And if you're calling locally, please dial 297-5633. You may reach us online via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff guest is Naomi Wolf, the well-known author and feminist and a person who has been on the American scene for well over two decades. She is best known, perhaps, for The Beauty Myth, which is now more than 20 years since its Odyssey as a bestseller. But she has penned what is termed by many to be her most provocative work to date. Good morning to you, Naomi Wolf.
Good morning. What a lovely intro. And just to correct the record a little bit so people don't think I'm very elderly. It's 20 years since
the Beauty Myth. No, you are still young, no doubt, and you started early, and certainly one of the most beautiful guests we've ever had, and we're very honored to share the microphone with you. But let's start with your work that is out and about now and is, as I said, the most provocative work to date and probably the most controversial book of the year, starting with the title. You go out there.
Well, it's what the book is about. The book is called Vagina, A New Biography.
That's a big topic.
It is a very important topic, yes.
So, go ahead.
Well, I just to kind of ease the sort of shock of anyone who might be just tuning in and wondering what is this, it's, you know, I think it's a very, very, or I'm hearing from readers, it's a very helpful and very supportive approach to a real issue, which is that 40 years after the sexual revolution, the numbers are not so great for women's sexual happiness. About 30% of women self-report as a problem for them that they have low libido, little sexual desire, and another 30%, some of the same women, some different, report as a problem for them that they don't reach orgasm when they want to. So I did a lot of research with the latest findings in neuroscience, especially in other scientific discoveries of the last 10 or 15 years, and what I found out kind of explains why this is. There have been a lot of new discoveries about female arousal and orgasm that are not widely reported that should help us completely understand better, you know, what women are and what women need. And so the book is really about it's actually about the brain-vagina connection, because scientists are finding that there's a lot of data supporting that there's a relationship between these parts of women.
Well, as the satisfaction for women, has it changed in recent times? Is it better? Is it worse? How does today compare with, say, the sexual oppression that some would say we had in the 1950s and earlier than that?
That is a really, really good question. A lot of good studies were not done before Masters and Johnson and the Haidt Report in the 70s. So we don't really know about how today compares with the 50s, but we do know that the numbers are in some ways going down for women since Sheer Haidt wrote the Haidt Report in 1976 and since Masters and Johnson. And that's really bad because we're living in a hyper-sexualized culture in which porn is everywhere, and yet there's a lot of disrespect for female sexuality and bad information about female sexuality. For example, Masters and Johnson said and this became very common knowledge or conventional wisdom, even though it's wrong, as it turns out, that male and female sexual response cycles were pretty much the same. They said there's arousal, plateau, climax, and resolution. And yet what scientists are finding, and that I document in my book Vagina, a new biography, is that male and female responses are very, very, very different, down to the very role of neural wiring in the pelvis. If you look at medical illustrations of the male reproductive system, it's very regular. The nerves are like a grid. I don't know how explicit I could be, but like a grid around the penis. Whereas if you look at the same medical illustration for the female reproductive system, it's this beautiful but very, very complex tangle of what are called neural termini, like beautiful, beautiful Christmas lights, you know, like but 7 or 8, you know, different neural termini all over the female pelvis. And I won't name all the places that they terminate. Your readers can read about them in the book. I want to be mindful of people, of sort of children running about. But the point is that every woman is different, whereas men are quite regularized. And there are many other differences.
The new book from Naomi Wolf is Vagina, a New Biography. Now, considering that most of the country and most of the world is heterosexual, how much, since you're talking about mind-body connection, how much do men play in the lack of satisfaction that you note from women?
Well, that is a wonderful and important question, and I applaud you for asking it. And I also want to, you know, really kind of praise and appreciate the fact that half of the people in my audiences are men. Because I, you know, the data show that a lot of women in marriages are reacting by sexual withdrawal. And of course, this is very painful for, you know, the men who love them. And it's partly because, as the men I interviewed said, this culture doesn't give men a lot of good information about how to make women happy. You know, I think it's great that readers are using information in the book to, you know, to make their wives and girlfriends happier. Like, one example is this, again, the differences between male and female sexual response. The autonomic nervous system is very, very important in female sexual response, more so than male. And what is this? It's that part of your body that regulates stress and relaxation. So this means that a woman really needs to be relaxed, to be free of bad stress, including emotional stress, for very heightened arousal, for her heart rate to go up and her, you know, the blood to flow to all parts of her body, making her skin more sensitive, you know, filling her, you know, vaginal tissues with blood and helping with lubrication and all of those good things that make her feel really, really, really good. But bad stress closes down that autonomic nervous system response. So what this means is that if your, you know, husband or boyfriend or partner snaps at you at 7 o'clock in the morning and then wants to make love at 7 o'clock at night, a woman can't just switch into being sexual. She really needs that emotional, she needs some, like, the takeaway for men is if you want a woman enthusiastically to want to make love to you for the rest of her life, you have to be nice to her and partner with her in de-stressing her, so, you know, for the rest of her life. So if housework is the issue, you know, that stresses her out, doing housework really is foreplay. You know, if she feels like you never talk to her, talking to her really is foreplay. These things are not imaginary. They are scientifically backed up.
What about the distractions that most of us have in our worlds today? We have so much going on around us that quite often I would think that we're preoccupied as far as being with our respective partners.
That is definitely true, and it is a big deal. And I think it's really reflected in, you know, how high divorce rates are. I mean, let me give you one other interesting example from the things that I discovered about female sexuality. When a man holds a woman so that her head is against his shoulder, or takes her slow dancing, or cuddles her in bed with his head on her shoulder, it actually releases substances in his, believe it or not, in his sweat, in his armpit, that have a powerful effect on a heterosexual woman's brain. It's male sweat, believe it or not, de-stresses women who are heterosexual, helps regularize their menstrual cycles. It boosts luteinizing hormone, which makes women more easily aroused. In fact, straight women can tell male aroused sweat from unaroused sweat. So the act of holding a woman in your arms really, really has a powerful effect on her emotional well-being. Women's bodies react differently to stroking than men's do. Non-sexual stroking boosts oxytocin in women. If after 10 minutes, she likes you 10% more. So the takeaway is, you know, in our distracted, busy, crazy society, no one's really telling couples, look, you know what, you know, it's worth it for 10 minutes on Sunday morning to lie in bed, you know, to lie in each other's arms. It's worth it for you to take her slow dancing. You know, these little things that seem like triage, you know, you can dismiss them. You can't dismiss them because over time, if men don't attend to these emotional needs in women and physical needs, they fall out of love with them. And so, putting it much more positively, if there are little things that we can do, and I give a list of them in the end, you know, that men can do for women or anyone who loves a woman can do for a woman that help us stay in love, that's good for our families, it's good for our relationships, and it's worth making a little time for.
Naomi Wolf is the guest. Her book, as you might surmise, is a bestseller, as were her other works, starting with The Beauty Myth in 1991, and not only a bestseller in the United States, but worldwide. But that said, as you know, there have been some harsh commentaries about your latest work. Has that disappointed you?
Not at all. People were very, very upset about The Beauty Myth when it came out in a very similar way, and now it's just part of the conventional wisdom. I stand by every word I wrote. You know, men and women are emailing me every day saying, you know, thank you for writing this book. It's really, these insights have really helped, you know, whether women are alone, they need to know about, you know, how to feel good, the brain-vagina connection, which we haven't really talked about these positive mind states that you can, you know, look after by taking care of your sexuality. And people in couples need to know. Our divorce rate is so high, and kids really suffer. And men suffer when they don't know how to make women happy. So I stand by every word I wrote.
Now, many know you also as a political advisor, in particular with Albert Gore in 2000. That was a campaign that didn't work out to the point where he got elected, although he got more votes than George Bush. But you
right.
told him to go alpha male, didn't you?
No. That was a Republican National Committee urban legend. And no, I was an advisor on women's issues, things like flex time and family leave.
Well, according to reports, and tell me if I'm wrong, but you were suggesting wardrobe for him and brown colors.
I'll tell you exactly what happened. The reports are very wrong, but they're distortions of two real things that did happen. I did write a memo in which I noted that a president's role is different from a vice president's role and seen differently. So if he was transitioning from the vice presidential role to a presidential candidate, he needed to take that into account. That got distorted into the alpha male, beta male, you know, urban legend. And also, it's certainly true that I was looking at TV ads slated for October and November that had footage from summer in which the whole family was wearing summer clothes. And I said, this is going to look out of touch and out of date unless you have fall footage with, you know, where people are dressed appropriately for the fall. So that's how that got distorted into it.
Well, to tie this in with your latest work, as we know, men are visual creatures, perhaps more so than women. But do women respond when a man is dressed in a certain way? Is that something that that is appealing?
I don't know. I didn't look at that. What's much more clear is that if men treat women a certain way, good things happen in the relationship. For example, the average man reaches orgasm in 4 minutes. I mean, I'm sorry to transition so quickly to the, you know, the nuts and bolts, but that is important information. And the average woman takes 16 minutes. So one thing that's obviously wrong in our sexual script in this culture and the prevalence of porn does not help is that the kind of pace of what women expect themselves to kind of measure up to is escalating and escalating. And so, you know, one thing that men have learned from, you know, the data that I offer in my book is to slow down.
All right, hold that thought, Naomi Wolf, and we will return with the author, Naomi Wolf, after this 1 minute timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org works as well. A few more minutes with the fascinating author Naomi Wolf. Her new book, as stated, is probably the most controversial work of a distinguished career. Her work is entitled Vagina, a new biography from HarperCollins, and as you can surmise, an overwhelming bestseller. Now, as we went to the break, you were talking about how men get satisfied more quickly, generally, than do women, and that's something that men, I suppose, should take into account when they're with their partner, but quite often with men, as we occasionally are, is it all about us?
Is it all about us? I'm not sure.
Well, is it all about us as far as satisfaction? Do we neglect to take into account how to satisfy our, is in this case, we're talking about female partners.
Right. Well, I don't want to blame anyone. I mean, there's just so much misinformation out there, which is one reason I did feel it was important to offer this, you know, this new information. For example, so I don't think it's about anyone being selfish. I mean, individuals are selfish, obviously. I do think it's about poor information, and a lot of the men I interviewed said porn was particularly unhelpful in teaching them about how to deal with women. I also have a chapter about the health risks for men that are emerging from chronic use of pornography, which is very important. It's another reason that men are reading this book. But just to go back to things we didn't know, one thing we didn't know is some basic elements of female anatomy. So I mentioned the numbers of how few women or how many women say they don't reach orgasm when they want to. So it turns out that anatomists have found a new neural structure in the anterior wall of the female pelvis such that the clitoris is the north of it and the G-spot is the south. And the reason this is important, and it's the same structure. We used to think about these two parts as very different. What's important is that 90% of women in lab conditions with strangers reach orgasm when both of these points are stimulated at the same time. So that's, you know, those are big numbers compared to the numbers of, you know, women not having that information or their partners not having that information. So that's a handy takeaway. But more important than looking at pleasure or sexuality in a you know, separate from the rest of the woman, what is really fascinating to me about these findings is, as I mentioned, the brain-vagina connection. It turns out that when a woman is supported by her society and by the people around her and by herself in allowing herself to anticipate pleasurable sex, it boosts dopamine in her brain, which goes to drive, motivation, focus. When she has an orgasm, it boosts opioids, which are about transcendence, bliss, ecstasy. And then when she also has other things in lovemaking, like, well, I don't want to get too graphic. You can read about it in the book.
Please.
It boosts oxytocin, which is that closeness. So you know, the amazing insight is that pleasure is actually psychologically beneficial to women, and it empowers them. And I thought that this was a very important finding.
How much of sex is in the brain, though? And if you talked about the mind-body connection, and there have been people who have written, as you have, about this issue, if it is an issue, and then they say that it's most of it's in the mind.
Right, exactly. Oh, so in the mind, it's incredible. Barry Komisarek at Rutgers found that women who are completely paralyzed from the waist down could have orgasms completely in their, you know, their brains were registering orgasm well. You know, their bodies were sort of physically not online. It's incredible how much the brain is involved. And again, that role of the autonomic nervous system in women, with there's one study where when women, you know, reached a certain amount of intensity with their orgasms in a brightly lit clinical setting, and then the same women in a comfortable, seductive, lowly lit, beautiful setting had four times the, they measured by microvolts, four times the microvoltage of orgasm. And so these little things that men are taught, you know, seduce her till you get her, little things like dimming the lights, playing music, you know, bringing flowers, pardon me for that siren outside, it's New York City, words of appreciation, they're not so little. They actually have a measurable effect on the female body. from the female response.
Mm-hmm. The book is...
And I'm sure, you know, the same is true for men. I mean, a whole book could be written for men. Apparently, men's bodies have a positive response when women express respect to them, which mm-hmm. I can understand.
Vagina, a new biography from Naomi Wolf, who has been involved in many facets of American life over the last two decades, including politics. And before we part company, a few listeners have asked us about your perceptions about the presidential election this year. What's your take on the two men who are vying to be the president of the United States, Governor Romney and President Obama?
I hope I won't disappoint your wonderful listeners who are asking, I hope I'm not bumming them out by saying I really think of it all as theater at this point, because the same 12 entities own both parties at this point, and there are really so few differences in who gets in unless we continue our, you know, citizen revolution to take back the democratic process from the ground up. And that's that's regardless of party. It's not a partisan issue. It's about the Constitution and the rule of law.
That's a point of view that many share with you, that they're frustrated with the American process, and perhaps that explains why turnout is so low. Only 57% of the American voters showed up in the last election. So maybe it's because Americans are frustrated with the process and what it does to the candidates.
I think that's right. On a happier note, I see a lot of very exciting grassroots organizing, and a lot of it is transpartisan, like the 10th Amendment Center and the Bill of Rights Defense Committee working together from the left and the right to fight the National Defense Authorization Act, which is this evil bill that Obama put forward, and no doubt Romney would continue to advance, which would allow the president to, you know, kidnap American citizens and hold them forever without charge or trial. So that's really the fight that we have. It's not left or right. It's citizens versus, you know, entities at the top that want to take over the process for their own sinister purposes, commercial purposes.
And lastly, Naomi, why do you think there's a gender gap in American politics? Polls show that in national elections in particular, women generally vote as a majority for Democrats and men as a majority vote for Republicans. Why do you think this is the case?
That is really interesting. I thought it had narrowed, but your data is probably more recent than mine. I would guess that women are aware because of our role as mothers, often, that circumstances can change suddenly. You can lose a husband, you can be on your own, you can lose a breadwinner, and that social welfare safety net is important for everyone. I think it's harder for a woman to have illusions that she can go it alone, you know, at all times and make sure to put food on the table for her kids. But that's just my best guess.
You are left of center. I don't think there's any doubt about that as far as your politics.
I don't know if I would call myself that anymore. I don't. Maybe I'm sort of left libertarian, but I think I care more about the Constitution and civil rights than anything else on the spectrum. But sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, in addition to the other fascinating aspects of your life, I have read that you have had a religious epiphany. Is that correct?
Well, I try not to talk about that because these things are very personal, but... I have a spiritual life, and it's important, but a lot of people have, you know, a spiritual life.
But in your case, it was a specific encounter, correct?
I don't really want to talk about such a personal thing in public. It can easily be misconstrued. In our, you know, we have a lot of culture wars in this society, and a lot of them divide along religious lines, and... you know, this is quite a private experience. So I promise to write about it someday in the future, but I want to be sure to contextualize it myself.
Okay, fair enough. The book from Naomi Wolf is stated an overwhelming bestseller. Her latest work and the most provocative of other provocative works, Vagina, a new biography. Thank you, Naomi. Good to visit with you.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You too. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. 297-5633, 877-217-5757. Those are your numbers as we switch gears. And we're joined by State Representative Stephen Ortego. He is a young man in a hurry, a Democrat who is in a conservative-dominated legislature. And, of course, we have a Republican governor. But Stephen Ortego is taking aim at cuts made to health care in Louisiana. John McGinnis, by the way, in his latest column, writes, for all, he has showcased school vouchers and improved national rankings for ethics laws. The most transformative change that Governor Bobby Jindal is responsible for, even if not taking credit for, is the ongoing dismantling of the public health care system that was a major legacy of Huey Long. Stephen Ortego, what's your take on what's going on regarding health care in Louisiana?
Well, Jim, first off, good morning. And, you know, I'm sure you a lot of people have seen the open letter that I sent out to the LSU board members last week. Before their decision on going back and changing their mind 2 months later on a plan to go forward for the rest of the year on with the healthcare system and specifically with the hospitals. There are 10 hospitals, although they were cutting 7 of them.
So what does that mean?
Well, it means that there's going to be a lot less access to health care for many people in Louisiana. 1 in 4 people are uninsured. It also means that that it's going to be harder for us to train our doctors. We already have a doctor shortage pretty much everywhere in the state except for the southeastern part. But my side of the Atchafalaya, we already have a doctor shortage. And you know, I'm very, very concerned right now about the future of the training programs in our hospitals.
Well, the LSU Board of Supervisors met last week and okayed a plan from the Jindal administration to slash 34.5% in funding for the LSU hospitals. State Representative Stephen Ortego responded by writing the LSU Board asking them to reject those cuts. Have you gotten any kind of response from the LSU Board of Supervisors?
Well, I haven't gotten any responses from anyone on the board. I've gotten plenty of responses from just people in my district as well as people all across the state who are really disappointed. Also, with you know, it's also the idea that there's this sort of tearing down of the LSU Medical School. This idea of saying that it's inefficient, that it's antiquated, and that it needs to somehow be modernized. You know, whenever I look at it, LSU has a lot to be proud of, and I don't think that anyone should be discouraging applicants or destroying the reputation of the medical school. You know, when you look at it, LSU's accomplishments include that they've shifted very fast to a primary care model. 70% of the visits are outpatient right now. The HEDIS indicators, which show sort of the effectiveness, show that they're actually doing better than those on Medicaid and Medicare in other places in Louisiana. And they actually rank in the top 20% of cost efficiency in the University Health Consortium. So there's much that LSU can be proud of. So that's one of the things that I just don't understand, how a board of a university is going to sit there and misconstrue their own record.
You're right that Representative Ortego, am disappointed that the LSU Board of Supervisors is considering changing its mind and voting on a totally different plan 2 months after making a unanimous vote approving a plan from Dr. Fred Cerise. The Cerise plan saved critical services, writes Stephen Ortego, preserved the LSU residency program. It also allowed lawmakers an opportunity to reprioritize funding next year to protect life. Why do you think the board changed its mind?
That's a very good question, because you went from a unanimous plan 2 months before, and so that's another thing that I just don't understand, is changing your mind on such huge decisions like this affects a lot of people, and it also just it creates a instability in the system where people are just not sure what's coming around the corner, and it's hard to invest in a safety net system like charity hospital system whenever you're constantly fearful of what's coming around the next 2 months. So you know, and with Dr. Cerise's plan, what I saw in it was, yes, they had a lot of sort of patch jobs that wouldn't be necessarily sustainable for the following year. But at the same time, it cut the legislators out of the conversation. And we're the ones who are going to vote on the budget next year. So they don't know how much they're going to be given the following year.
Do you think the board is just following the governor's edicts lockstep? What's your take on how much influence Governor Jindal has on the LSU board?
Well, I sure do feel that way, as well as I think a lot of people feel that way.
So that's not going to change as far as the governor having control of the board. He appointed most of the members. They serve at his pleasure. Go ahead.
I don't know if you'd say that they serve at his pleasure, because they are appointed for they're appointed for a specific period of time. In Louisiana Constitution, it's sort of a revolving where the governor at the time appoints someone ever so often.
Yeah, that's 6-year term.
Exactly. So it's an appointment to a term. So I don't know if it's necessarily serving at the pleasure, but you're right that they are people who are appointed by the governor, so they're obviously going to lean very, very far towards what the governor would like to do.
Well, the healthcare situation is such that it's a major component of the budget, the biggest component, and money is tight now. And the governor has stated he doesn't want to raise taxes. So, what options does he have?
Well, the first thing is this. You got to remember this recent cut is not due to a change in the amount of revenue that we're getting. This is just 2 months later, a decision to we're going to cut sooner rather than later. We're going to cut now instead of allowing us to get to the end of the year and allowing the opportunity for the legislature to make sure that we reprioritize here in Louisiana. And we've always been a state that has valued life. And you can see it in the charity hospital system that's been around since the early 1700s.
Stephen Ortego with us, representative from District 39, a Democrat in his first term. And you're out in front on one of the big issues of the day. And you're this time around, you're speaking as a member of the minority in the House of Representatives, and a minority as far as the governor being a Republican and you being a Democrat. So what do you think, when all is said and done, Stephen, what do you think your words will do as far as changing any minds that matter?
Well, first off, I would say maybe I'm in the minority party, but I don't think I'm in the minority whenever it comes to issues especially issues of valuing life, and especially with this particular cut. I mean, I saw a poll that came out last week that showed that almost 90% of Louisianians were very concerned or concerned about the cuts to the charity hospital system for LSU's hospital system. So I don't feel like I'm in the minority when I go around in my district in the Lafayette area. I definitely don't feel like I'm in the minority on this issue. This is an issue that since day one, the day after being sworn in, sitting in a meeting with DHH, and they're sitting there talking about mid-year budget cuts to our local hospital, UMC. And it's like it's a sort of continuing drama here.
We will go to the phone lines in just a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation, Inkster Show at WRKF.org or 297-5633. We return after this one-minute pause with State Representative Stephen Ortego. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we resume our conversation with Representative Stephen Ortego. He writes in a letter to the LSU Board of Supervisors that over the past few weeks, he has had many young people telling him that they wanted to go to LSU for medical school but are now reconsidering because of uncertainty surrounding decisions related to the healthcare budget. Reverend Randy and Zachary, good morning. You're on with Representative Ortego.
Good morning. My question to you, Representative Ortego, is will not these cuts also have an effect on private pay patients as well, with the number of people reporting to the emergency rooms and doctors' offices sort of be seen? And also, why is it that the legislature will not stand up to Governor Jindal and call a special session to address something that has such dramatic effects on our community. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, well, thank you for your question. He's absolutely right that it's going to have an effect on the healthcare system as a whole. You know, in particular, I was looking at the closest hospital to UMC in Lafayette as an example, is Lafayette General. And whenever you look at the amount of visits to the emergency room with those two hospitals combined, you're talking about being overloaded even after an expansion where they're almost double the overload of what their capacity is. And so it's definitely a big concern for a lot of people. It's a big concern for the private hospitals. I know they're very concerned about the capacity in their emergency room. And, you know, there is a statute that says that they can't cut out an emergency room without approval from the legislature. But what they've done is in particular, and I've seen it in a couple of them, where they cut out all of the ICU beds. And I've asked a few of my friends who are doctors if they could operate in an emergency room if they didn't have ICU beds, and every single time they said, absolutely not. It's not really an emergency room if you don't have ICU beds. I actually think it's pretty dangerous to sit there and have a sign that says emergency room and people show up to it, and you just have to stabilize them and ship them to another emergency room.
297-5633 is your number for Representative Stephen Juan Ortego, 27 years old, first-termer, Democrat from Karen Crow. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, you're on the air with Representative Ortego.
Good morning, gentlemen. My questions are, does the Louisiana Constitution structure in place right now, is that what affects what programs can be altered? I mean, as far as revenue, I understand there are entitlements and things and the way that is set up. Or is this part of the privatization project that's going on that the ALEC people want to try to get in, putting in vouchers and vouchers for health care and vouchers for schools?
Well, it's a little bit of both and then even some more. Some of it is federal funding, the way the federal funding and federal match dollars come down, encourage or discourage certain things. And there's been changes in that, as well as, I mean, the Constitution, really some of the only things that it protects are K-12 education. But there is some room to move around, but you have to remember almost two-thirds of the budget is health care and higher ed. So that's the reason why health care and higher ed end up being on the chopping block every time you talk about budget. Is it a good thing? Probably not. I think that we need to value both of those things, especially healthcare, because if you're not healthy, it's hard to learn, you know. And I mean, it's like I said, it's a little bit of the funding mechanism from the federal government also, and the matches, and that's actually being used to blame right now is a change in the FMAP, which is the federal matching program for Medicaid, and it's being used as an excuse right now by the administration for the cut to the LSU hospital system. It wasn't the federal government that came down and said you have to cut LSU. It was the federal government just changed the matching. The decisions could have been made differently there.
297-5633, 877-217-5757 for Stephen Ortego, who Kevin has pointed out was elected at 27, is now 28 years old, so still a very young man. Paul in Opelousas, you're on the air with Representative Ortego. Hi, Paul.
How you doing, Jim? How you doing?
Hi.
How you doing, Representative Ortego from Opelousas? Question
I'm
on
good.
The...
I was born in Opelousas.
Welcome. Hey, come back sometime.
I live in Karen Crow now, so...
I hear you. Just a question on the hospital system. Before LSU was in charge of it, the state was. Could LSU just unhook themselves from the responsibility of the charity hospital system and be back in the state's hands? And how would that work?
Yeah, I guess you're referring to, I think about 15, 16 years ago, they switched over, maybe a little less. They switched over where LSU started managing the charity hospital system before it was DHH. And one of the things that I pointed out in my letter was that LSU's done a great job since it's taken over of switching becoming a lot more efficient than what DHH was doing before. And like I said, they've switched over to mostly an outpatient model, which is primary care, which is a lot cheaper, a lot more efficient, keep people healthy before they end up showing up to the emergency room, which costs a whole lot. So that, you know, if you switched it back over, I don't know if it would change anything on the cuts, because it's still the executive branch. So.
All right. Thank you, Paul. 297-5633. Still time to get in with Representative Ortego. Since you're taking aim at the LSU Board of Supervisors, do you think there should be a revision as far as the boards of higher education in Louisiana, Representative? Would you be in favor of a single board, for example?
A single board
of higher education, rather than the LSU board,
the Board of Regents,
Southern Board.
I don't know. I've never really put very much thought to it. I've been very focused more on what's at hand and the health of people and also the medical education in the state. So I haven't really given much thought. I mean, we can't really do anything right now necessarily because we're not in session. I know a caller earlier asked about us calling ourselves in the session. I know that there's been some movement there. I don't know if we have the votes or not, but I do know that it must be getting close because that's what I'm hearing. So,
you think there's a possibility it might happen?
I think that there's a good possibility every day that goes by, but at the same time, I question if we're actually be able to get anything done when we get in there, or if the governor would just veto everything that we pass.
297-5633 is your number. And Stephen Ortego, who is a young man who's in the state legislature at the age of 28 and unafraid of taking on a governor who has wielded power mightily in his two terms in office, Governor Bobby Jindal. Have you had any response from the Jindal administration?
No, I have not. I'm just focused on looking what's within the law and what is within the powers of the legislature, because there's not much more you can do. These decisions come down, and they seem to be pretty hard on their decisions.
Buddy in Broadmoor. Buddy, you're on the air with Representative Ortego. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I was hearing a conversation, and I work in the health field. And I remember back in 2003, Medicaid cut funding for inpatient psychiatric hospital beds. And a lot of the hospitals around the state, private hospitals, cut back on psychiatric beds, which created a need for more psychiatric placement, inpatient placement, for especially the poor and the middle class. And that has been a problem ever since then. One of my concerns that I have is this concept of vouchers for medical care. I'm getting ready to turn 65 and go on Medicare before too much longer, and I also have a single private policy for myself. And for me to get health care, it costs me about $5,000 a year in premium, and another $5,500 that I have to pay out of pocket before my insurance company pays for a prescription. And my question is that if we go to a voucher system, both nationally and here in Louisiana, does that mean that the state or the federal government is going to fork out a voucher for, say, $700 a month to cover somebody like me?
Representative, what do you think?
Well, first off, I'm not as familiar with Medicaid as Medicare or the LSU hospital system, because it's a federally run program rather than a state run program, and I don't know a whole lot. I've heard that talking on the national level about a voucher system. I'm not really sure exactly how it works. But one thing with the LSU hospital system in Louisiana is that we know we at least have access to care. Even if we fall on hard times, it's a safety net for us and our families. And the thing is, even with like a Medicaid card, for example, the Medicaid card in Lafayette, Louisiana, will not find you orthopedics. It will not treat you for HIV/AIDS. It will not You will not find a dermatologist. You will not find a urologist, and the list goes on. So the Medicaid card doesn't necessarily mean access. But the nice part about the charity hospital system is at least we have access for everybody to these sort of care.
Stephen in Mid-City. Stephen, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Jim. Good morning, Representative. I wish you luck. I hope that you make more than your first term. I know I couldn't spend that much time with those folks. Unfortunately, Bobby Jindal was elected by a, quote, majority of the people to do exactly what he's doing. I worked in the system for 17 years, and I like to consider myself the headlight on the train wreck that was coming when Governor Foster appointed him to DHH. He shut down the first adolescent program in the state, and it has since now we are shutting down Southeast. He is shutting down Southeast. He's shutting down Central. All the services that were formerly provided by a state system that would take those patients the private sector would not take because they were too violent or they were too poor wound up at Greenwell Springs Hospital, Central, and Southeastern. And they got excellent care. I worked there 17 years and supervised many excellent social workers, psychiatrists, and medical practitioners, some in training, some full-time. And we had a wonderful system. I worked at OK Long, where we had access to MD Anderson.
All right, what's your question?
The question is, when are the people and the legislators who passed all that stuff and the Board of Supervisors going to get a set and say, we've had enough. You've taken Louisiana from the 20th century back to the 19th century when we were just creeping into the 21st.
All right. Representative Ortego.
Well, I think it's going to have to first off come from the people. I mean, we're going to have lots of people showing, you know, they got to get out there and you know, it's I guess, safety in numbers. United, you're stronger. And then second off, I mean, I see a little bit more and more movement, like I said, in the legislature towards realizing how important this is to the people of Louisiana. It's almost part of our culture, like I said. Culturally, we've always taken care of our neighbors. And you know, in other states, and we were talking about the state getting out of the business of this sort of stuff. What ends up happening, though, is then local governments have to come in and try to make up the difference. So they go right back to the taxpayers and ask them for more taxes. So there's an issue there also of trying to shove. You say no more taxes, no more taxes. But at the same time, when you cut so much services, you end up forcing the local people to try to tax themselves to make up for these sort of things. And Louisiana is a small state. You know, you look at places like Harris County or Cook County, where they have a charity hospital. And it's a whole county that's got more than 4 million people in it. When you got 4.5 million people in Louisiana, you know, you have to look at a sort of system to get some efficiencies out of the system.
Terry in Monticello. Terry, good morning to you. You're on with Stephen Ortego.
Yes, I want to know that if Governor Bobby Jindal has to close down all these hospitals in Louisiana, why didn't he take the money from the federal government that they offered, you know, millions of dollars?
Well, that's a good question, too, but we have to remember that the money that he's refusing won't come until 2014. So it's a little bit different. He has some time to change his mind on that, too, but it's very much a very good question. To me, it's like you almost want to do one or the other. You know, you got to make sure that people are cared for, whether it's through the charity system or it's through Medicaid.
You write in your letter, and let me make sure you wrote as you intended. You say the charity system's been around since 1736.
Yeah, well, it you know, it was during the colony actually, and it was started in New Orleans in 1736.
You mean we had a charity system in Louisiana 76 years before we became a state?
Yes.
And you're saying now it's in peril.
Correct. And very often I hear the line from the administration is that it's antiquated system. It's an antiquated system. I just kind of ask myself, well, when did it become antiquated? Was it 50 years ago, 100 years ago, or 200 years ago?
Well, it'll be interesting to follow. And what do you think will happen?
I think that they're going to continue to try to take it down. I unfortunately think it'll take a long time to build it back up. I think whenever you know, there's preservation mode, there's investment mode, and there's destructive mode. And I feel like we're definitely in this destructive mode here on our healthcare system. And I think it takes a long time to invest and build it back up.
Stephen Ortego, out in front on a major issue, one of the youngest. Are you the youngest member of the legislature?
I'm the youngest serving. Right?
Youngest serving at the age of 28. Stephen Ortego, Democrat, pride of Karen Crow, home of Rapid Ron Guidry. Thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to a return visit very soon, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Take care. And Ray Gleer, who's written a fine book about the Southeastern Conference, how the SEC became Goliath, has agreed to come back at a future time. We wanted to spend as much time as possible this morning with Representative Ortego, and that we have done. Tonight, it's the vice presidential debate, which will be heard right here on WRKF with Vice President Joseph Biden and Republican nominee Paul Ryan, who will square off, and we will see what happens in the second big debate of the presidential campaign. And we'll be talking about it tomorrow right here on this show with Democrat Trey Orso and Republican Ben Baggert. Until tomorrow, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.